My name again is I'm Philip Brasher. I'm the Washington correspondent for the Des Moines Register, and I'm really privileged to be here with this panel. I think most of you you're here because you know we've got a problem if the climate forecasts are right. There are estimates that we've already need to double food production globally over the next 40 years or so, just to keep up with the growth, the projected growth in world population and economic growth anticipated in places like China and India and many other parts of the country, parts of the world. At the same time, we're going backwards in terms of addressing hunger. The number of malnourished, according to the UN, is now over a billion people, worsened by last year's run-up in food prices. And now we have this climate issue. We have, I think, collectively four people here who I would challenge you to find four people who know more about the scientific, economic, and the policy implications of climate change in agriculture than our four guests here. I have asked them, each one of them, to address quickly a couple of questions to kind of frame the issue, and then we'll open it up to your questions and let you interact with them and them to interact with each other. First of all, we have Claudia Riegler. She's a senior research fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute. It's based in Washington, where she co-leads the water research program of their of IFPRI's Environment and Production Technology Division. And over the last 5 years, she's been focusing her research on the impacts of global warming on the developing world. She's also co-author of this report, just came out within the last couple of weeks, in which IFPRI, economists at IFPRI have tried to model the impacts on food production and malnutrition in global food supplies based on the climate forecast, the best climate forecast. We have, fortunately, a number of copies of this report back on the table back there, so feel free to grab one and take it with you. So with that, Claudia, could you what do we face? What do we know about what we face in terms of trying to address producing enough food to feed the world over the next century?
Yeah, thank you very much, Philip, for the very kind introduction, and also thanks for the invitation to be here today with all of you. This is my first conference addressing journalists, so it's, I think, very exciting for me. Usually we only talk to scientists and policymakers. I guess the key question is, as Philip just mentioned again, is are we going to feed a growing population on a hotter planet? And we already have to increase food production between 2000 and 2050 by 190%, and that is, you know, with or without climate change. And the answer is yes, obviously we will. We will feed a growing population, but climate change will make it much, much more difficult than if we could operate under historic climate. And basically, if we do not change the way we invest into agriculture and the way we are subsidizing agriculture and the policies that we have today, we are very unlikely to achieve any further declines in poverty and malnutrition in the developing world. And as Philip already said, about 1 billion people go hungry. It includes about 160 million children. And if they go hungry, those are often lifetime irreversible consequences, regarding their learning capacity, their productivity. They will basically never achieve, what they could if they were fed adequately. And that is the decisions we are taking today, and we actually have already taken in the last couple of decades. But as Philip has already said, climate change is only one of those many stressors that affect food production. There are others on the supply side, including growing water and land scarcity, overall decline in investments in agricultural research and infrastructure, higher energy prices, and on the demand side, of course, population growth, rapid economic growth in many developing countries, resulting changes in dietary preferences. So China, Sub-Saharan Africa, India, starting to increase meat consumption, dairy consumption, vegetable, fruit consumption, etc. All of that also impacts how we can feed the world. And of course, there's this most recent stressor that has contributed to the food price crisis, which is biofuel demand, particularly the one the maize for bioethanol conversion. So all these stresses are out there, and climate change is yet another stressor. And what we also have to be aware of, that all the climate change impact modeling focuses on only growing temperature and changes in precipitation patterns. It doesn't focus on typhoons and climatic extreme events like floods and droughts, sea level rise, glacier melt. It's very difficult to model that, so it has definitely not been adequately modeled. And a lot of the impacts that we are seeing today focus more on the climate extremes and less on the creeping change. But the IPCC results focus only on the creeping change in terms of scenarios that we can then translate into agriculture impacts. So basically, we are definitely underestimating total impacts. If we look at the direct biophysical impact from climate change on crop yields, we definitely see that overall the yield impacts are negative, with the exception of a small increases for rain-fed maize. The Asia-Pacific region is expected to experience the worst effects on rice and wheat yields worldwide. We see smaller yield declines in African countries, but they will matter much more to local populations, as the region is much more vulnerable to climate change because of the dependence on rain-fed agriculture, high levels of poverty, low levels of human and physical capital, and obviously poor and non-existing infrastructure, which is really at the core of many things. Overall, we see the strongest crop yield impacts in South Asia and Asia overall, followed by the Middle East and North Africa, then Sub-Saharan Africa, and the relatively lowest impacts for Latin America. That's I'm focusing on developing countries. When we translate this biophysical yield impacts into economic and trade models, and obviously also once we take into account technological change, that is still, you know, it's the most important change for us to feed the future populations, then we can see that trade flows, changes in trade flows, higher food prices, and technological change actually help us to ameliorate, to mitigate this adverse, direct biophysical impact on crop yields. So we will see lower overall impacts. They're still negative, but obviously because we'll export more food into developing countries, so those who can afford it, you know, will be slightly better off than if they would just have to rely on locally produced food. We are also obviously seeing higher food prices, so that'll trigger another supply response, so there'll be additional focus on producing food, similar to what we've seen a little bit now. But higher food prices will dampen food demand for the poorest, so again, the most vulnerable people will have less access to food. From our projections, we expect that maize prices will increase by 50% by 2050, rice by about 35%, and wheat prices by almost 100%. This is out to 2050. So the direct impact will be that calorie availability per capita per day will decline, with availability, especially in Sub-Saharan Africa, falling below the 2,000 kilocalorie threshold. And again, another result of that is that the number of malnourished children is set to increase by 20%. That's comparing 2050 no climate change scenario to climate change. So that'll just get the number closer back to what we have today, because under normal climate and business as usual, we do expect continuing declines in malnutrition, apart from Sub-Saharan Africa, where we always, it's very difficult to reduce it there. So what can we do? What should we do? What can we do against that? There's a whole series of investments and policies to counteract the adverse impacts from climate change. They include investments in agriculture R&D to get crop productivity going further and much more rapid, rural infrastructure, and the provision of rural services. So investments in these sectors, equivalent of about $7 billion a year, can help increase agricultural productivity by about 60%, which would get the number of malnourished people and children back to the number we have today. Of course, this is not really what we want to achieve, but at least it'll help us to counteract some the adverse impact of climate change. So it can be done, but again, only looking at higher temperatures and changing precipitation patterns. Where would the money have to go and in what kind of sectors? Basically, in sub-Saharan Africa, it's mostly rural infrastructure, rural roads, and also irrigation systems. In South Asia, the focus has to be on irrigation, including especially irrigation efficiency, because they have very scarce water resources. I mean, not scarce, but they're much overused, so so they have become scarce. So basically, we can... My point is we can adapt to climate change. We have to help the group of developing countries to adapt to climate change. And adaptation and mitigation actually in developing countries can generally go hand in hand. But it does require significant investments in policy reforms today. And if you wait another 20 years, you know, once we'll go back to, again, higher food prices, it's going to be very difficult to achieve these changes because these investments are all long-term. Those are my points.
Next is Jerry Hatfield. Jerry is one of this country's leading experts on the agronomic impacts of climate change. Jerry is the supervisory plant physiologist at the National Soil Tilth Laboratory in Ames, Iowa. And he last year he was the lead author of the agriculture section of an intergovernmental report on the impact on land, water, agriculture, of climate change. That report, if you haven't had a chance to look at, is a very good resource in terms of, although the data is changing constantly and the research is ongoing. But anyway, Jerry, could you talk to us about what's going to happen as far as we know and what we don't know in terms of crop production and the impact on crop production in the United States?
Thanks, Philip. And it's really, we think about the impacts of climate change. One of the pieces of this is you think about we have a temperature impact, we have a precipitation impact, and we have a CO2 impact. Plants responding, all of those. And we tend to think about some of these climate impacts as being a function of temperature alone, or we think about it as being precipitation alone, or we do the very positive thing relative to CO2, and we say, you know, all is going to be good with rising CO2 because plants love that. But in reality, one of the things that you see, and all you have to do is look outside the window and realize that we are moving into a regime in which temperature and precipitation are moving into much more variability than what we've experienced in the past. And it is that variability that wreaks havoc on agricultural systems. And it wreaks havoc because of the types of conditions that occur. We are modifying our precipitation patterns. And if you look in climatic history, we have a certain expectation of precipitation patterns throughout the United States. The Midwest, we expect April, May, June, July to have a fairly uniform precipitation. But in reality, under climate change, we're seeing wetter springs, drier times during July and August when we want to promote grain filling in that plant, wetter falls that have caused problems with harvest. And so we're seeing this variation that begins to occur within the season. A lot of this is induced by how our climate change is interacting with natural cycles that are going on. El Nino, Pacific Oscillation Index, North Atlantic Oscillation Index, there are a lot of natural cycles that are going on around our globe that climate change exaggerates some of the magnitudes of those. And those all impact agriculture. And we often just limit it to the direct impacts. We think about a temperature impact on crops, or we think about a precipitation impact on crops. But the indirect impacts may be as of greater magnitude as the directs. And the indirect impacts are because of how climate is influencing weeds, insects, and diseases. And those are the things that detract from yields as well. And if we think about this in a very simple complex, is if we change our temperatures slightly, we could move in the upper Midwest from one population of corn rootworm, which causes a lot of destruction, to two populations in a year. And if we do that, farmers are going to have to change their whole management practice. We think about diseases in the same way. Instead of maybe one disease cycle, two or three disease cycles in areas. And if you move just from north to south, as already in a lot of those disease cycles, as you move from Iowa down into Louisiana, is that we may move from one or two disease cycles to 15 disease cycles in a normal year anyway. So all of these things are the indirect impacts. And so those have implications in terms of how plants are going to respond. And everybody knows weeds love what we do anyway. Weeds are actually responding more positively to rising CO2 levels than our crops. They're becoming much more prolific, a lot more seed production, and a lot harder to kill in terms of being able to manage those as part of our agronomic system. The other piece of this is that we will continue to see an increasing probability of heat stress events in which we'll have periods in which it's normal and all of a sudden that temperatures are going to rise greatly. And that has implications for crop production, but it actually has even more implications for animal production. Animals that are in feedlots or even dairy animals that are outside, those spikes in temperature cause a reduction in milk production. Because it's just like you and I. Think how you respond when you have subjected to being one condition, all of a sudden it gets very, very hot, is that you don't like that very much, you know, because you're not accustomed to that. Animals are the same way. And so it takes them off of feed, it reduces their milk production, rate of gain, makes them more susceptible to some of the disease stresses out there as well. The other piece of this puzzle that I think we need to realize that links a little bit with Claudia's comments is that as we change climate and weather during the season, there's going to be a major impact on the quality of the produce, whether it be grain, vegetables, number of things. I'll give you a couple examples of this. One of the examples is aflatoxin in corn, which is mediated by weather occurrences. Will there be an increased probability of some of these fungal diseases that influence our grain quality crop? The other one that we all know about is the actual quality of wines are from year to year a direct in correlation with weather. Will we see more impacts on crops like that because we rely on a certain sugar content in that grape? Will we be able to achieve that? And the other one that's another piece of that is protein content in wheat. If you think about wheat going into milling products that goes into bread, the millers and the bakers want a certain protein content. If we change the weather slightly, we can move that protein content from being an acceptable level to being a non-acceptable level, and so they're going to have to do different blending exercises to achieve a bread quality. So all of these pieces that are out there that are somewhat forgotten when we think about the climate impacts, we tend to think about, well, is corn yield going to be up or soybean yields or wheat yields going to be up? But in reality, it's these ancillary impacts, the indirect impacts from insects, diseases, and then the quality impact of that produce that's induced by the weather as well. There's a lot of challenges out there in terms of how do we look at this. So.
Given us a lot to think about.
That's my job.
Yeah. Did it well. Well, next is we have Dave.
Dave is a hard person to describe. He wears many hats. But Dave set up what is the first national program for pooling agricultural carbon offsets through the Iowa Farm Bureau. It's now called the Aggregate Climate Credits Corporation. Dave was also a key player in writing the rules for agricultural carbon offsets on the Chicago Climate Exchange. He knows this issue well in terms of mitigation.
He also is Director of Research and Commodity Services for the Iowa Farm Bureau Federation, which means he keeps track of policy on a whole number of range of issues. In his spare time, I don't know how he does this, but he also runs a 400-acre farm in southern Iowa, where I believe all of it is no-till, and he probably gets carbon credits on all of that, I presume. Although they're not worth a whole lot right now. Anyway, Dave, you've heard and know these some of these challenges well, and the predictions. How are farmers going to respond to this, and can they increase production?
Well, I think the first thing we do is take a look at what is necessary to feed the world in 2050. And I think the three big factors that we've got to start with are, first, we need the scale of it has been laid out. We kind of start with what will people want to eat in 2050, and the data would suggest they're going to want to eat about 50% more cereals, about 100% more meats, and that will require about 100% more cereals to support the meat production. Now we may, in society, wish they would eat something different, but that's what they want to eat. And I suspect the system will produce what they want to eat rather than what we tell them they ought to eat. Somehow systems seem to do that. And so coming from that practical perspective, I step back to the question, well, what's necessary to feed that world? And I think the first thing is you got to have profits that stimulate investment. One of the big concerns about between the next 40 years, between now and 2050, is what is happening to investment in agriculture. And I would suggest that, in fact, if there is a success story about biofuels, it is that it has stimulated investment in agriculture. You can always divert grain to food if the production exists. You can't do it if you don't have the production to begin with. We found that in biodiesel as an example. We built biodiesel plants, and it stimulated some development of some core products. And as soon as the price shorted the food market just a little bit, we diverted almost all the oil back to human consumption and away from biodiesel plants. But that production capacity existed because of biofuels policy that helped stimulate the initial investment that expanded that production. In the U.S., we have expanded. We're using about 4 billion bushels of corn for ethanol production. And in the same time, we've had record corn exports. So we've not done this at the expense of food. But part of what stimulated the ability of the producer out there to expand yields and get record yields, we're looking at in Iowa, the prior record yield in Iowa on a state basis was 180 bushels an acre. Yesterday's report suggested Iowa this year will be 188 bushels per acre corn yield. Part of that is technology investment, the seeds, the fertilizer, the technology for precision agriculture that are all contributing to adaptation of the circumstances that a farmer faces today are part of a response to $4 corn. I would suggest if corn were $2 a bushel, we would not have a record yield in Iowa this year because the investment into that crop would have been much different. And so there is a need, if you will, I would argue, in the short run to actually stimulate productive capacity and technology and investment in this capacity building that can be changed over the long term into other uses when it's appropriate. Technology is going to play a great role in that. In terms of some of the adaptations, I look at the role of genetically modified crops right now, and I'm not going to sit here as an economist or as a statistician and say that all of this may – I'm not sure there's pure causality here, but there sure is correlation. The highest – the crop with the best yield growth rate has the most technology investment in it from a genetic modification standpoint, and that's corn. We've got developments that are addressing rootworms, addressing corn borer, addressing both fungal diseases, insect diseases, cold tolerance, herbicide tolerance, etc. And we've got a yield growth rate that is about 50% higher than the population growth rate. Our corn production capacity in the U.S. is outstripping population growth, which is what food demand has to do in the long run, if you're going to meet it. Yield growth on soybeans, where we have basically one set of technologies, which was herbicide resistance at this point to a large degree from GMO, we've got a growth rate in yield that is about equal to the population growth. And on wheat, where there have been no GMOs, we haven't had any growth in the yield pattern for wheat in the U.S. in 20 years. And there is no technology developments going on in wheat. In fact, wheat production in the U.S. has been stagnant. I think there's a real strong correlation between some of those things in terms of the aversion to technology in certain products, and the fact is we're not seeing any growth in yield productivity of wheat on a worldwide basis, and definitely not in the U.S. I think those are issues. I think we must not sacrifice ag production in the name of greenhouse gas reductions. We have got to figure out how to be more energy efficient with our inputs, and agriculture probably is one of the great success stories. Per unit utilization of nitrogen, for example, which is one of the huge greenhouse gas issues of nitrogen fertilizer application, we have gone in the last 25 years from about a pound and a half of nitrogen per bushel of corn produced to under a pound. We've cut that, you know, tremendous. Now, we're applying almost the exact same nitrogen poundage in the U.S. today that we applied in 1985. Applied nitrogen is almost the exact same poundage. But instead of a 7 billion bushel corn crop, we'll have over a 13 billion bushel corn crop coming out of the exact same amount of nitrogen. Now, show me another industry. I suspect we are not getting as much heat per unit of gas burned or light per unit of coal burned that's seen those kind of technology increases. Agriculture is the great success story relative to energy efficiency in those regards. We need conservation, not preservation. I worry about some of the policy perspectives that I see in legislation that designs things in the terrestrial world, if you will, for greenhouse gas mitigation that are all designed around preservation. When's the last time you ate something that was grown on a preserve? We need productive working lands to solve these issues, not isolated preservations. And adaptation is more important than mitigation for agriculture in the short run. I point to, in the face of the second warmest global summer, this year was the second warmest global summer, if I saw the data correctly, of the past 100, 150 years, whatever it is. Iowa and the Midwest in general had the third coldest summer. So in the face of the global situation being the second warmest, we had the third coldest. As a farmer, I cannot plan and adapt to what might be 30 years from now on today's crop. I am awful glad I planted a shorter season variety this year that is maturing ahead of and in spite, you know, is delayed compared to last year because of the lack of heat units. But if I'd have planted a normal variety, I probably would have been caught by this weekend's killing frost. So adapting to what's expected to be a longer growing season over time would have been the wrong strategy in the short run. That's a mitigation strategy that we need to do in the long run, but in the short run, I need to adapt to things such as Pacific decadal oscillators, El Niños, all these short-term weather effects. And so when I look at it, the other thing that I think we have to look at that's probably a huge question, it is, do we have a food production problem or do we have a food distribution problem? I've seen a number of reports that would suggest that we grow enough food in the world. In fact, we have 35 million acres of productive farmland in the U.S. sitting in a reserve program. Europe has a significant amount of acreage sitting in reserve programs. We have productive capacity, substantially. What we don't have is good distribution systems of getting food to where the food is grown, to where it may need to be. We are seeing some acreage shifting. Some of the projections, for example, on biofuels were we were going to run out of corn. Well, what we're finding out is we're shifting cotton acres from ground that used to grow cotton is now growing either corn or wheat and soybeans. Wheat ground is going to corn or soybeans. Corn ground is becoming more predominant in the northern hemisphere and soybeans a little more predominant in the southern hemisphere. Adaptation in the very short run much more prominent than mitigation. I'll stop there.
Next, finally, Bill Hohenstein is the director of the Global Change Program Office in the Agriculture Department. That means he is the coordinating climate change research and programs and working on policy, and very busy right now as the cap and trade bills work their way through Congress. So, Bill, talk about what the administration, what's Washington doing, and to what extent they recognize this.
Sure, and it's a pleasure to be here this morning. I'm going to keep these remarks brief. I think the objective is to try to get as many questions in as possible. So I'll talk a little bit about policy responses. And I understand you heard from our secretary yesterday, and mm-hmm. you might have given a perspective on some of this. This the issue of climate change is critical to the administration and to our secretary in particular. With regard to policy responses, the policy responses with regard to climate change, kind of fall in two categories. There's mitigating climate change, and agriculture can play a very important role in that, and obviously adapting to climate change. And I try to tell folks that, agriculture, when push comes to shove, agriculture is really on the receiving end of climate change, that farmers and ranchers are dependent on a stable climate system to plan and to produce the goods and services that we all depend on. But the responses with regard, the policy responses with regard to mitigation and adaptation are actually quite different. To mitigate the buildup of greenhouse gases requires international coordination. It's the classic tragedy of the commons issue, where you can't – one country or one individual acting alone can't actually address this issue. And so it requires coordination at a national level, understanding – what it's going to take to reduce emissions and increase carbon sequestration, and also coordination internationally to make sure that all the countries that are contributing to this actually are part of the response. The policy approach on adaptation to adapt to climate change is actually quite different. Greenhouse gases pretty much have the same effect regardless of where they're emitted. On the impact side, the impacts are going to be localized, and the implications for farmers and ranchers across the U.S. and around the world are going to be quite different. I think as Jerry can talk probably in much more detail, the regional expected effects of climate change in the U.S. are going to be very different depending on where you are. If you're in the Intermountain region and in the Southwest, you're likely to be most heavily affected by the fact that it's going to become drier and hotter. In the north and east, maybe through the central part of the Corn Belt, it's likely to be wetter. The southern states are going to be more heavily affected by temperature increases. And these same sorts of patterns exist globally as well, where countries around the world and regions in these countries are going to be affected very differently by climate change. But the capacities are quite different. If you look at the capacities within the U.S., within U.S. agriculture to adapt to climate change, they're quite different than the capacities in most developing countries. When you look at the availability of alternative cultivars and the quality of the information that we can expect farmers in the U.S. to have, I think the infrastructure that exists allows for improved adaptation. And so when we look at the expected impacts of climate change, and I think Claudia's report is a good example of this, the impacts on agriculture are likely to be disproportionate in developing countries. And that's going to obviously have important interactions with food security. And so improving the capabilities of developing countries to improve food security, develop productivity improvements in their systems, and to integrate climate change adaptation into that is going to be quite important. One of the challenges we face is that the quality of the information we have about climate change itself is actually still limited. We understand at a global and a regional level how climate change is likely to play out. But in order to provide sort of the practical advice and guidance that we need to give to farmers, we need to have better information about how climate change is likely to affect them. We need to be able to tell folks like Dave how the climate system is going to change in Iowa, not so much how it might change over the broad area of the northeastern and north central U.S., which is about what we can say right now. When we look at how adaptation will need to play out in the U.S. and the policies that will be needed to support that, I think the first thing to focus on is sort of the long-term capital investment needs. And if you look at how climate change is likely to affect agriculture, the initial effects are likely to be with regard to water and use and water availability, especially in the western states. And there, you know, because of the need to make long-term capital improvements in water storage capability and water handling, those are the kinds of things that we need to be thinking about now that will be useful 10, 20, 30, 40 years down the road. The other types of investments that we'll need to be thinking about in the relatively short term are things on the animal agriculture side to improve, to continue to improve productivity, but also to make sure that things like cooling barns and those sorts of things are taken into account as farmers make decisions about capital investments. Looking globally, you know, obviously there are strong synergies between efforts to improve food security and efforts to adapt to climate change. And these can take a couple of tacks. One is to focus directly on productivity improvements, improving cultivars, improving genetic selection. Equally important will be to indirectly improve productivity and focus on food storage and distribution systems, reducing losses and spoilage. There's great potential to improve access to food and improve overall productivity by focusing on these areas. Just in terms of what the government is doing, we recently announced a commitment to support global food security. This was announced by Secretary Clinton. And it's going to basically integrate climate change adaptation into this food security effort. The focus is going to be on country-led plans and within that, community-led plans within countries, a strong emphasis on leveraging private sector investment, recognizing that governments aren't going to be able to do this on their own. And the focus within country is going to be on improving access to inputs, and that includes fertilizer and improved seeds, access to extension. I think the model that we have in the U.S. for extension, for getting information out to farmers, is a model that other countries could be adopting. And finally, improving market access and market infrastructure. And that gets to this issue of how do you actually get food from the crop to the consumer without losses. So why don't I stop there? I think we teed up some issues we can talk about.
Okay. Thank you.
Back to you, Phil.
So go ahead, open up now, questions, and we'll address it to whichever one, and we'll let the others respond. Go ahead.
Thank you, George, for working public broadcasting. I just want to follow up on that, what you just said about extension services. Is that happening? Are you working with any developing countries right now?
Well, in fact, there are a couple of things going on. Secretary Clinton just announced this commitment to support global food security, and the focus on extension is contained within that. USDA has a strong history of working through our Foreign Agricultural Service on this type of thing. We basically work with the Agency for International Development. Our scientists and our conservation experts and our extension experts and those in the university system travel abroad and work in countries. Yes, and so essentially it's building on that model.
Go ahead. And please, again, identify yourself.
Yes, I'm Urban Lehner. I'm editor-in-chief of the DTO, the Progressive Farmer. And I'd be interested in following up on that question about extension, hear about extension in the U.S. now that we've reorganized our extension service into NIFA. I'm sure I can tell you what the acronym stands for. I just hear the acronym. Anyway, it seems like there's a huge emphasis on research in this new agency, and I wonder if that emphasis on research will come at the expense of the extension service available to the American farmer who's trying to make these adaptations.
Please, Kais Mujeri, please repeat the question.
Sure. I guess I can take this one. The question was basically the USDA is reorganizing our Cooperative Research Extension and Education Service into the National Institute for Food and Agriculture. And whether this will actually reduce the emphasis on extension. And I think that actually Raj Shah, who's the undersecretary for research, education, and economics, would probably say it's the opposite. I think there's going to be a heavy focus on extension. I know that there's also going to be a specific focus on energy and climate within this new NIFA. But I think extension is going to play an important role in all of the four pillars that they have for this, for how they're reorganizing our university cooperation and our grant system on ag research. And I don't know, Jerry, do you have any more detail to add on that?
Well, obviously that NIFA was just rolled out on Thursday in terms of the press club introduction on that, and I think the details are yet to be determined. But in a conference call yesterday with Dr. Shah, it was very apparent in his challenge to USDA scientists and heads of extension and education groups that his expectation that all three of those would be coming together, that we would meld together not only the research base but the education base and then the outreach or extension base all simultaneously, so that the information as it was developed would make sure that it got to proper audiences. So I think that we'll see a restructuring of that. You just don't see education extension in the title, but I think it'll be one of the goals of NIFA to make sure that that does happen.
I think that'll be a real challenge as we move forward. Extension's built on three legs. There was a federal, a state, and a local element to extension when you really, particularly when you look at the outreach part of it. And, you know, I don't want to generalize from what's happening in Iowa, but I, having spent 7 years in the Missouri extension system as one of the area specialists, I've got some insights to it. And Iowa, in fact, is, and many of the Midwestern states are defunding extension. You know, so as we're maybe reorganizing at the federal level, the availability of funding for extension at the state level is significantly reduced from what it was 5-10 years ago, and in the current economic recession is being significantly defunded. But I would also say information flows are much different than they were 10-20 years ago. As a commercial farmer, I rely much more on commercial entities for technical and agronomic outreach and services than I probably did 25 years ago when I was farming, and I relied on the extension service for those. So the U.S. system is evolving. I think it's a separate issue. I think relative to developing worlds, I think the U.S. model is great, but if the developing world is going to take that model, they really need to understand the strong commitment of funding that it takes to duplicate what we had in the 50s, 60s, and 70s in terms of an educational system where there was no commercial ag structure to carry that message. And so there's been some real changes going on in the last even 10, 20 years in the U.S. And I'm not sure if the U.S. Extension Service as it exists today would be an effective model in the developing world unless you have the commercial ag systems to support it, because that's what our model is doing, is supporting a commercial ag system. It's not as near as broad in going out direct.
I hear a sort of implication here that in the announcement that was made by Secretary Clinton about the National Institutes for Food and Agriculture, is that...
Two separate things. There's an announcement regarding U.S. efforts to support and promote food security globally. That's a global initiative. And then there is the reorganization within the Department of Agriculture of the Cooperative Research, Education, and Extension Service into this new National Institute for Food and Agriculture.
Well, thank you for that clarification. It does sound, however, like the efforts to attain food security in the developing nations implies that we're going to try to export the American models of agriculture to... That's what David was just suggesting, and I've heard that suggested before. Could you speak to that, please, Bill?
Sure. No, and I think, if you look into the details of how this announcement was rolled out, I think there's going to be an important focus on country-led efforts. The countries are going to be asked to come up with their plans for how they would proceed, and there's going to be a focus on community involvement in that. I think, I don't think this could be one-size-fits-all in terms of how to move forward. I think there are certainly lessons to be learned from how the U.S. model for conservation and for extension that may apply in countries. But I think there's also going to be a need to focus on the priorities of the countries, and then also how what could be effective in terms of how to proceed. And that includes things like how do farmers in these countries obtain information. What are the critical priorities in terms of improving both productivity, but then also food or commodity storage and handling? Are the critical needs on the transportation and the infrastructure side? I think there's going to need to be flexibility in terms of how once you get and working with countries in terms of what those responses are going to be.
You did say, I think it was you, Bill.
Yep, I think that is certainly one of the things that's included in this announcement.
In that process, I'm just thinking about the cultural connections here and the efforts the United States might be making to respond to the cultural priorities of the people in these countries, such as being able to keep seed from one year to the next and not rely just upon the GMO seeds that are patented by American companies.
I think we have to be careful, though, in terms of making some assumptions on how some of these things go forward. Looking at data, for example, out of China, China has had almost the exact same rate of growth in corn yield over the last 20 years as the U.S. has. But their corn yield is now equal to what ours was in 1965. China applies more nitrogen per acre than we do in the U.S. and gets half the yield. Well, if you look at the efficiency productivity measures on, for example, energy use in grain production, the U.S. has been having this great advance, if you will, in utilization productivity of nitrogen per bushel of corn. China's increased their yields, but it's been all by increasing fertilizer use. They have not figured out how to get the productivity out of that nitrogen, and that is the technology advances that are, I think, predominant in the developed world is how do you get efficiency out of the technologies. It's one thing to adopt better genetic seed and more fertilizer availability, but then how do you take the next step and get productivity increases out of those individual inputs? And the reality is nobody in the world is matching where the U.S. is relative to ag productivity out of the resources invested into them. And I would suggest a big, strong reason for that is nobody leads like the U.S. relative to technological advances in unlocking the ability of these energy inputs, such as nitrogen and fertilizer and those things, to be expressed in yield and other things.
Claudia, could you jump in here?
Yes, thanks. I don't think we need to worry too much about China because they're doing an extremely good job. They're investing not the number one and the largest investment in agricultural research among any developing country, and they're increasing their budgets every year for agricultural research. So I don't think we have to worry about them getting their ag system together. In terms of why they're overusing fertilizer, it's very poor subsidy policies. It's just poor policy right there. There's no need for them to subsidize fertilizer to the amount they're doing. They're trying to change it, but it takes time. Obviously, also, why don't they get the same yield and have much, much, much poorer soil and water resources there? I mean, they have very, very little water per capita compared to the United States. The land resources are extremely scarce. The farmers operate at 0.2 hectare, per farm. So, I mean, they have like nothing. They have the small plot, and it's a bit more difficult to use precision type agriculture in China. But for what they have, I think they're doing an extremely good job. I would be much more worried about sub-Saharan Africa and parts of South Asia where, we have especially Africa increasing numbers of malnourished people. And there was an issue, is it a distribution issue problem? Is it a production productivity problem? I mean, the problem in Africa is, of course, the United States and Europe can export more maize and other crops into Africa. But in Africa, you have still 60 to 80% of the people are farmers. So what are they supposed to do? Come over to the United States and Europe? Or, I mean, what we really want for them to get out of poverty and have access to money to buy the food is they have to produce, they have to become more productive, and the chief way in Africa at least happens to be agriculture. So the focus has to be on strengthening agriculture productivity there. And that's, again, as we've already heard from all the speakers, is a variety of issues. Basic infrastructure, there's no road, so extension is not interested to go into remote areas if there's no road half of the year. So getting the basic infrastructure done, getting the government commitment done. So IFPRI and others have been trying for years to get African governments to commit to spend 10% of their budget resources on agriculture. So 80% of the people work in the sector, but they cannot. It's very difficult for them to commit to spend 10% of their budget on this sector. So it's a government commitment question. It's a rural infrastructure investment question. Many African governments really try to focus their investments on urban areas where the power is, where the voice is, whereas in the rural sector has very little voice in those countries. So it's basic infrastructure. It's, as Bill said, it's access to markets. It's better seeds, adapted obviously to local conditions. They need more water infrastructure because they have lots of water resources, but there is just no, 95% is rain-fed agriculture in Africa. And just given, you see the climate variability here, and it's definitely drier there. It's already hotter there. So that's going to be a big issue for them to produce food in the future. So basically the focus has to be on those countries, improving productivity there. That's not to say keep increasing productivity here. Definitely that's needed as well, but the solution is not to export more food into those countries. It's not the solution for these countries.
Claudia, I want to pick up something Dave said. He referred to conservation versus preservation. And mm-hmm. in Washington now, with the cap and trade bill, this issue is starting to percolate. Some people call it carbon versus food. I heard a lobbyist for the National Corn Growers Association the other day made the comment that the cap and trade was going to be fuel versus food times 10. And that's this question of, can you increase production at the same time you're trying to mitigate climate change through either
preventing land from being converted, deforestation, trying to convert land to forest to reduce emissions, reducing nitrogen use to reduce emissions of nitrous oxide. How do can we? Is there a carbon versus food issue in the United States or globally?
I mean,
is that a real concern?
I'd like to speak for developing countries. There, it's actually not that much of a trade-off. For example, in the Indo-Gangetic Plains, the major wheat-producing area in northern India, Pakistan, they have started all the zero-till farm management practices. It's actually, so it sequesters much more carbon. So actually there, it's both adaptation to climate change and mitigation of climate change in agriculture go hand in hand, and that's much of what's happening in the developing world. So what we actually want is that these farmers then also get credit for doing all the sustainable land management practices they're doing. And then again, so in Africa, of course, there's huge deforestation goes on, so you want much more fertilizer on the ground, which actually will increase agricultural productivity and helps dam deforestation. So again, it's actually mitigation, putting fertilizer on the ground in many of these countries because they're mining fertilizer. So much of what they're doing is already, you know, they could do a much better job. So a lot of the adaptation mechanisms will help mitigate climate change because right now they're really operating so suboptimally from what they could. So if they would produce more efficiently, it would help mitigate climate change. And obviously it's good for them for adaptation. It includes enhanced soil water conservation technologies, zero-till, then more agroforestry practices. I mean, the mechanisms are all out there. But the question is, can they get the core benefits from carbon credits, access to carbon markets? And then B, it's to get these systems into place that are both good for adaptation and mitigation, you need, again, the extension service, you need the rural infrastructure, and obviously access to the inputs. Yeah.
Jerry?
Let me add a little different wrinkle to this, and the fact that we often talk about carbon within soils, and we just kind of envision, you know, carbon being stuck in there, and it's kind of a big bank for it. But in reality, what we need to be thinking about is the fact that if we're going to increase food production into the future, we're going to have to improve the water use efficiency of our overall systems, because water use efficiency is about how you take and convert water into production out there, and it's a linear trend. And so one of the pieces of this puzzle that often gets overlooked is that our soil is our reservoir for water availability to that plant. And by increasing the carbon content, organic matter content of that soil, we improve its water holding capacity. So we make more water available to that plant. We also make it more resistant to erosion. We improve its nutrient cycling capacity. So there are a lot of benefits that occur and accrue within soil that will allow us to adapt and to mitigate some of the impacts of climate by improving the soil resource. We talk about China not getting very good productivity, and Claudia mentioned the fact that it really is pretty low in terms of our nutrient use efficiency and the soil resource. Part of that's the fact that it's the water limitation of those soils, and water limitation in a lot of our soils in developing countries that prevent those inputs from being efficiently utilized. And we see the same thing across the Midwest. A lot of our yield variation isn't due to the fact we mismanaged nitrogen or didn't put the right hybrid in there, the right cultivar. It's the fact that we have a water limitation late in the season. And so in a lot of these developing countries, we're going to have to make sure that we develop the soil to make sure that water is available to that crop in order to achieve the productivity that's out there. And then you can realize the benefits of improved technology, and then fertilizer management, her hybrids that go with that, a number of different things. So we have to realize that we're dealing in a very complex system with lots of different parts, and these are some of the roles that are out there.
I think one of the things, you know, and Jerry hits on it there, is building up our soil resource not only can be beneficial to the climate in the short run by being a carbon sink or through sequestration, but we are probably building up the most valuable natural resource of the world for future generations. It's one of the things that a current generation can actually do that helps a future generation. Much of what we do is probably in the current political climate is borrowing from the future generations. But, and most of the things that are carbon positive relative to agronomic practices that you can do to build carbon are very good to the soil resource, to the environment, those types of things. There are synergies that exist there. And so when we look at carbon policy, one of the real questions from a policy perspective is, can we set a framework of policy on a public basis that encourages public investment into, and public investment because we're all part of the energy consumption world, if you will. So public investment, not necessarily tax dollars, but systems that encourage energy efficiency, energy utilization, but also agronomic practices, et cetera, that are healthy to the soil, et cetera, as part of carbon mitigation strategies, and not look at carbon mitigation strategies in a silo. I think you can get some real unintended consequences if you only look at carbon mitigation. I am very bothered by some of the estimates that would say afforestation practices might convert 40 million acres of U.S. productive cropland into afforestation. Those type of policies, one, I believe there's real bad analysis out there. But two, I think those types of things, it gets back to, we cannot mitigate greenhouse gases on the back of food shortages and creating problems in our basic subsistence systems.
Just real quickly, I think, since we're kind of bringing in mitigation, I think, when you look at the global greenhouse gas puzzle, you can't just put agriculture off to the side. I think if you look at the proportion of emissions that come from agriculture globally, it's about 13% to 17%. Another 15% or so comes from deforestation. And so if you look at the greenhouse gas profile of the globe, about a third of it is related to land use. And a significant component of that is within agriculture. That's a very different profile than the U.S. has, where 6% to 7% of our emissions come from agriculture. And so it's not simply that you can put agriculture aside and say we're going to deal with emissions from energy use and ignore these emissions. If you're going to be dealing with climate change globally, you've got to focus on how to address these emissions.
Herbie, you've had, can I get somebody that hasn't asked a question?
I'm Bill Ann, and I teach at the University of Missouri Journalism Program. My question is about the politics of this. We're talking to a panel of folks who seem to agree that climate change is on the way, whereas in the farming community as a whole, that's in a slightly different perspective, including to the fact that perhaps Mr. Miller could answer, and maybe even Philip. The Iowa Farm Bureau seems to have a more progressive viewpoint on this, and their efforts at climate, carbon sequestration, et cetera, seem to be quite a leading element, whereas last I checked, the Missouri farm is somewhat reactive. Could you help shed some light on what's going on there?
A little bit in terms of, because people do ask, well, how in the world did Farm Bureau become the first aggregator of agricultural carbon credits that existed out here? And I give a lot of credit to a board of directors, which is all farmers, that had some foresight. But we approached it really, I was the staff person that was involved with this. We approached it on two basic fundamentals. One, we made a determination that whether we agreed with it or not, carbon markets were going to evolve. And we made that determination about 7-8 years ago, that carbon markets would evolve. And that because of the nature of the interaction of carbon with agriculture that this was not an insignificant issue, and our board said and agreed for us to get involved as an organization that we would be more able to influence and be educated on the nuances of carbon policy and carbon market development if we were inside the system than outside the system. So they said, as staff, go do good things. But secondly, it was this, it was really feeding off some research and stuff that came out of the soil tilth lab and other things that said all of the things that were involved with the Chicago Climate Exchange as a voluntary exchange relative to ag soils were good for current farmers, were good for agriculture, were good for the environment, and were good for future generations. Politically, I have a lot of problems with the Waxman-Markey bill, and I have a lot of problems with Boxer-Kerry if we want to talk specific bills and the politics of a specific bill. I think our organizations have the right policy relative to those bills. There's problems in those bills. I think there's some very major problems from an agricultural perspective. But that doesn't mean as an organization that we can't be involved with helping to develop and work with the development of carbon markets in a way that we think is synergistic with agriculture. But I can also tell you our board is now questioning whether the financial involvement because of the political uncertainty that's happened in the markets, political uncertainty has killed the voluntary carbon markets. They've destroyed them. They have really collapsed and fragmented, et cetera. And, you know, cost-wise, the Iowa Farm Bureau is going to spend a pretty good penny. We're not making money doing what we're doing. At some point, you because of the, and it, to a large degree, it's because of the political process.
I'll just say this, that I think if you talk to the groups that are represented in Washington, their memberships are not most of these organizations. I think their memberships are, this is not their number one concern out in the country, I think.
Well, I think there's a very fundamental base that is lost into carbon, in the greenhouse gas debate that has turned some of the ag community into the positions that they have. And that is that much of the debate has been an anti-energy debate. It's not been about greenhouse gases. It's been about anti-energy, that energy use is bad. And in the farm community, they just don't believe it. When you look at the ability of energy to take and expand the ability of our individual human labor to be productive, energy is a positive. When you look at it relative to standard of living, energy use is a positive. When you look at it from a number of factors, there's high correlations between energy use and quality of life. And I was at a conference about 2 weeks ago, and one of the speakers, his comment was, we have to figure out how to maintain the stat, and it was a political person, I won't name them, but his comment was, we have to figure out how to maintain the status quo by using less. And my response to it, I came on a panel later and I said, I absolutely disagree with that. We've been in an economy that's been status quo or slightly less for the last 6 or 8 months. Who likes it? No, my children and my grandchildren deserve an economy that's growing and vibrant. We need to figure out how to do more in a more efficient way. It is not about how do we just do less. And that is a fundamental factor that's been at the heart of some of this debate from a political perspective. And it's left a real bad taste in agriculture's mouth as a collective.
Last question.
Going back to the
Can you repeat the question, too?
Sure. It would be basically, can world agriculture become carbon neutral, and could U.S. agriculture become carbon neutral by 2030? I think I think within the U.S., if you look at all lands and if you include forests, we're actually sequestering more carbon in our forests than we're emitting in both agriculture and forestry combined. So within the U.S., if you look at the land sector as a whole, it is carbon neutral. I think the question that's more relevant is, you know, what are the opportunities to reduce emissions and increase carbon sequestration, and what role can agriculture and forestry play in an integrated response? And there, I think, you know, I think Dave talked about some of the issues with Waxman, Markey, and now the Senate bill, but there are opportunities that could be tapped into. And they can be significant. And I think in addition to, you know, directly reducing emissions from things like, you know, fertilizer use and from manure management, increasing carbon in soils on productive lands, I think there's the potential for agriculture to contribute on the renewable energy side. I think when you look globally, it's going to be even more important because of the profile of agriculture and deforestation in the global greenhouse gas balance. Neutrality globally, it's important to have goals, I think. And I think it's important for countries to basically, you know, I think do what the U.S. is doing in these negotiations, which is coming forward with some concrete ideas on how to get there, and then have follow-through behind that to make sure that these things can be implemented.
Jerry, what's carbon neutral? Carbon neutral farming?
Actually, it... A lot of the things that we do now is that corn production actually across the upper Midwest is actually a net sequester of carbon. Soybean production is slightly carbon negative. It doesn't take much to move it to the other side. And so if you look across the U.S., there's some tweaks in the system that we could improve or achieve carbon neutrality fairly quickly. It's not this big, elusive target out there. It really is something that's fairly doable. And at the same time, the adoption of those practices improve the efficiency of our system as well. Bill mentioned one that I'll just touch on, and that's nitrogen fertilizer, because one of the things that comes out of nitrogen fertilizer is nitrous oxide. If we go to materials that are either different forms of nitrogen or stabilizers that are put into nitrogen, is that we, in that case, improve the efficiency of that nitrogen use relative to the crop. So we can actually reduce the amount of nitrogen to put in and achieve even a higher yield. So there are lots of pieces of this puzzle, but we've got to think at it in a very systematic way. And we just can't cherry pick and say, well, we're going to change a tillage practice and achieve this. We really have got to look at the whole agricultural system as a whole and begin to move it forward with a goal of carbon neutrality. But it is achievable, and we spent a lot of time monitoring these ups and downs through the year. But you watch this and you begin to say, when you begin to do some of it, the end result is one of the comments that Dave made earlier, is that we begin to see that we achieve more productivity out of that per unit of natural resource input, whether it be water, nitrogen, carbon, or a number of different things. Those are the things, and those are the metrics that we need to be looking at to say, how is the system responding over time?
And to follow on that, a country like New Zealand, for example, has a almost total grass-based dairy system. The life cycle analysis of their dairy system is that it is more emission intensive than a U.S.-based system that tends to use grains, etc., to feed the dairy cows because of the productivity levels. Our average milk per cow is about 22,000 pounds per cow per year. Theirs is about 9,000. But the biggest emission that comes off a dairy cow is enteric emissions, both the front end and the back end.
Methane.
And other things that get burped out. But the reality is there have been these analyses that are critical of us feeding grains to beef cattle or feeding grain to cattle. Well, in a whole emission system, the U.S. system is one of the most efficient from a greenhouse gas life cycle analysis that exists in the world. These systems, I think, you know, there are some, I'll call it the myths out there, that simply going back to, quote, organic systems or going back to pastoral systems, et cetera, are necessarily greenhouse gas favorable is not necessarily true. Now, in some cases, again, it's back to generalities don't hold in a lot of specific local locations. So it's hard to make some of these big generalities. But there are those that say, well, we got to quit feeding corn to cattle. Well, that would probably raise net greenhouse gas emissions if we did so. You know, it's not necessarily going to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Claudius, what, just to wrap this up, what in Africa, for example, is it, how realistic is it to, I mean, and you're just trying to feed your family, greenhouse gas emissions are not the highest concern, but how realistic is it to what?
I mean, it would be wrong to approach these countries asking them to become carbon neutral, right? Because they're, as you said, usually they're basically at the end. I mean, they're getting all the negative impacts, so why should they, you know, like why should they keep paying for it? But I mean, but as I said, interestingly, in these countries, because as you said, the production systems are so inefficient. So in fact, if they become more efficient, you know, they're basically, it depends what you use as the objective. So if they could produce the same little amount of food they produce much more efficiently with better, higher inputs, and you know, they could thus reduce their carbon footprint. But what we actually want is that they will produce more food, and obviously as a result they will have to increase their carbon footprint. We want them to increase emissions, but obviously, you know, only relative, they will produce much more food with relatively less emissions. That's the objective. More emissions, but much, much, much of food. So the share of emissions per unit food produced will go down, can go down, and it's not very difficult. And if these investments are being done in infrastructure, fertilizer, seeds, water availability, so then their per unit carbon emissions will go down dramatically. And that's the objective. But not that we want them to, you know, not produce more emissions.
Yeah, if I can just say something quickly, and I'd agree entirely that if you look at the least developing countries, I think, you know, they're really on the receiving end of climate change. I think there's going to be a difference in terms of, you know, the priorities in terms of the climate issues for them. I think the other point that Claudia makes that's quite important is that there is a link between productivity and land use and land needs. And you know, one of the drivers of climate change is deforestation. And land competition and land use is going to be a critical issue over the next century. And improving productivity, getting more out of the lands that we have in production, is going to reduce that land pressure and help address deforestation, which is one of these drivers of emissions.
Well, thank you, each one of you, very much.